Hey, it's Bootstrap Web. We're here. Jordan, what's up, buddy?
Yo.
Hi. Brian, I feel like someone else is here with us.
Yeah, who's that? Who's that third dude here? Is that Ben Orenstein? The Ben Orenstein?
That's right. I'm here.
Yeah, all right. So you guys probably know this guy, Ben, from artofproduct.com and
artofproductpodcast.com.
Oh, artofproductpodcast.com. You got to get that right.
The other one costs money, I think. And, yeah, you know.
Yep.
Oh, yes.
And of course, you're the co-founder of Tuple, the new app being built. We're going to talk a bit about that. But, you know, like you do on your podcast, which I was on a couple of weeks ago, which was awesome. We're just going to bring you into our typical conversation updates. What are you working on? What are you thinking about? And yeah.
I think that works well. I've been on a couple podcasts as like an interview guest where it's clearly like there's the host and I'm the guest and they're asking me questions. And it's just so much harder to get into a good conversation, I feel like, in that dynamic where it's like I'm just on the spot every minute or two to talk for a little while. And I try to do my best, but it never feels organic or as good as I could speak.
Yeah.
Well, it's something you need to work on, Ben.
I'll try.
Cool. So we're just going to kind of get into it and see where things go. Ben, first question.
Please summarize your life for us.
What is Tuple and why are you building it?
Didn't we just talk about this?
Yes.
All right. This is the only direct question I'm going to answer.
For those of you who aren't up to date on what you're working on, what is Tuple?
All right. So there used to be this wonderful app called Screen Hero, and Screen Hero was a tool for remote pair programming. So two programmers who want to work on the same problem on the same computer, but they're not actually physically co-located. And Screen Hero was great, and I used it and loved it, and then Slack bought it and kind of sort of shut it down, kind of sort of rolled it into their product, but not super well. And I just kept asking my friends for like, hey, like, what do you use now that Screen Hero is gone? And I would like kept Googling like Screen Hero replacement, and I would just find more people asking the same thing. And so one day I went to a friend of mine, I was like, yo, dude, let's make a Screen Hero replacement. Like the game plan is basically there. We know the market exists. We know roughly what the answer should look like. It just got bought and shut down. And he was like, all right.
All right.
So we quit our jobs. Cool. We found their co-founder.
And wow.
Which is that.
So you have three of you?
There's three of us, yeah.
Wow. And what's the makeup of the team? This stuff always fascinates, like the origin team. You guys have like the trio of designer, product, and tech?
Well, this was actually an interesting conversation that we had at Martha's Vineyard at the trip you organized, Ben, because both of your partners were there. Why don't you talk about like the roles?
We're actually all developers. So all of us can write code. My two co-founders are Joel and Spencer. And Joel and Spencer are both very dev focused. Of the three of us, I definitely have the most other experience, I guess, like more marketing-y kind of things. Joel actually had like co-founded and sold successfully a startup before this. So I guess Joel has some experience there too. I think mostly on the dev side. So we're heavily concentrated on coding ability and a little stuff here and there outside that, mostly around me because I've been doing this sort of like wanton self-promotion, marketing-y kind of audience building thing for a long time. So I happen to come sort of with a bit of an audience already.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a product for developers. So that kind of makes sense that way.
That was a requirement for me, basically. It was like, if we're going to make... Well, it wasn't a strict requirement, but it was one of the things that pushed this idea of all the ideas over the line was like, look, I've got a following already that is these developers. And so like the marketing is just going to go so much better, I think, versus starting from scratch on a tool that's not for my audience.
Yeah, I mean, you've been building this audience for a long time, and you formerly came from working at Thoughtbot, which is, you know, very well-known Rails... I guess it's called a Rails agency.
Sure. Yeah.
We were talking at Martha's Vineyard. It's interesting to have three pretty strong technical background co-founders. And one of the things that we came out of that was like, hey, Ben, you should like not be coding, just so you know.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
When we were at that conference, the current state of the world was we're all focusing on development. And the thought process behind that was, hey, we don't have a product yet. So all hands on deck to make the product. But the thing that you guys brought up that I thought was really useful is like, there's a long lag time on marketing efforts. And so if you focus on the product now, and then when you actually have a product, start marketing it, it's not going to go as well as if you have been working on this stuff for months, because it just takes a long time to pay off. It was a clear case of over-concentration once you guys pointed that out, where it's like, it felt like a classic failure mode for dev-started companies, where it's like, we all know how to write code, so we'll all write code. that just seems like a great way to screw things up. So as soon as you guys said that, I bought it.
I mean, certainly two developers working instead of one on the product, you're going to move really, really fast, right? Three developers, yeah, you'll move faster, but is it really like 3x faster? And is the return on that investment versus somebody focusing on the marketing side? Like, where's the trade-off there, you know?
Yep. Definitely, we were at the point of diminishing returns, it felt like.
Have you defined your roles? Have you specifically said you are the CEO, you are the X, what?
Yeah, I'm the CEO.
Okay. So you got a different set of problems.
I do. Yeah, exactly. And so it felt like sales and marketing was more where I should be anyway. Mm-hmm. It's just like, well, if these are the roles, then let's do them.
When I hear like what you're doing, the question that comes in my mind is, do you clone? Do you basically just rebuild Screen Hero? Or do you kind of go from the ground up on like, well, we like Screen Hero, but here's how we would improve it? Or do you start off with the same basic set of features and then go from there? How do you approach that?
I'd say we're kind of taking a middle path where it's like we had a tool that we liked and we liked how they did things. So if there's a question and we're like, man, we really don't know how to answer this question, we think back to what Screen Hero did. And it's like, okay, that's probably a reasonable default. But at the same time, we're trying to not be totally constrained. Like our marketing angle on like we are a Screen Hero replacement, I view as very much a temporary thing. Like I don't want us to get pigeonholed into that for long. And I don't want that to be our pitch for a super long time. It works well now as kind of a shortcut. It's like, you already know this thing. It's like that thing. But eventually, I think that comparison will not be so useful, probably sooner rather than later. We're doing some of the same things they did, but we're also very open to the idea that like, hey, it's 2018 now. Things are different. We can do different things. We should have our own ideas and do them well.
I forgot if we talked about this, Ben, like about price, how you plan to price the tool, because it is a downloadable Mac software. Is that right? Or a component of it is?
Yep.
But are you going to be charging for it like a SaaS or is it like a...
Yes. This is all up in the air. Who knows? So I did do some pre-sales. So we have revenue, which is awesome, to people. And what I did with them and what I'm planning on doing, at least to start, is a per user kind of pricing. Like monthly.
But so like you download the Mac client, but you can't really use it unless you have a subscription account, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you're GoToWebinar.
Exactly like GoToWebinar.
Yes.
Yeah. Only like probably clunkier and kind of more enterprise-y.
Yeah.
You were running products within ThoughtBot, but you also got to see a lot of startups coming to like engaging ThoughtBot services. And I'm guessing that those were very different types of startups than we typically see in these circles of like self-funded bootstrappers and not so self-funded. And can you like contrast like what it was like for you the past couple of years in your work at ThoughtBot and seeing that whole landscape of startup software companies versus you working in one now and ones that you're talking to?
Not a ton is coming to mind, except mostly just around how much money was there to be spent. So ThoughtBot is a very boutique agency. It's very expensive and like pretty high minimum project sizes. So
like really only like VC funded startups are coming.
Pretty much. Yeah. It was like maybe like 60% VC funded startups and then like 40% existing larger companies that had a bunch of cash anyway.
How focused are the VC funded startups in terms of like the idea and the validation and customer research and building the right thing and like not wasting a ton of money working with ThoughtBot? Like what did that kind of look like?
So I think actually that is what ThoughtBot is best at, is focusing people who could blow a lot more money and getting them to actually figure out what an MVP looks like and testing it in a lightweight way. It takes a lot of discipline, I guess, and ethics and whatnot to say like, no, we're not going to do the $400,000 project. We're going to do the $40,000 project. And ThoughtBot is like really pretty rigorous and aggressive about helping people do lightweight user testing, do a design sprint to explore the problem space and test the assumptions in a pretty agile kind of way. And I think that's partly why they have been so successful for so long. Because often those things then turn into longer engagements where you spend a lot more money, but they're very good about like understanding that the problem for most companies is like knowing that you're building the right thing.
That's very, it's impressive because you can much more easily say, sure, we'll do whatever you need and then just probably get it wrong, but still make the money, but for the longevity.
Right. Maybe in the short term, that works pretty well.
So Brian, what were you really asking, like how do you take that experience of just being exposed to people saying yes to $400,000 projects and bring that over into our world? Because I know for us, it is a blind spot that at least we are aware of, that we don't know how to sell to the enterprise, and the enterprise could use our product in the same way other people use it, but pay 10 to 100 times more. So it's like this big glaring blind spot that...
I guess the reason I asked that to Ben is because I guess I don't have as much exposure to VC-funded startups and how they think and operate. Although, like, through audience ops and whatnot, I have sold services to them at times. And among those customers, there's been sort of a mixed bag. Like, some are, maybe they've had multiple rounds of funding and they're a more established company, so they already have a growing customer base, and those tend to be really great clients. But then we get some who are legit new startups, but they've closed like a big round of funding. And I don't mean to generalize everybody, but I've had plenty of conversations with folks who are like, yeah, we just closed this round of funding and we're still trying to figure out who is our customer. What are we going to sell them? We kind of have this idea. We're going all in on this hunch. I'm kind of hearing that. I'm like, I'm not hearing a whole lot of focus. And of course, it's very easy to be unfocused when you don't have that sort of mentality. Whereas in our world here, most people listening to this podcast, most people going to the conferences that we go to, I feel like this community has become really good at vetting and validating and doing things the right way. I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting contrast.
I will say I have been a little like shocked and scared at how quickly that discipline disintegrates. So like as we went from 4 people to like 18, my level of discipline of like, what's that? It's $100 a month and you want it? Sure. Like my filter for acceptance has gone down so much.
From a customer standpoint.
Yeah, as a customer. Yes, yes. And then all of a sudden what happens is 6 months later, you do a review of your finances and you're like, how much are we spending on software? What in the world? And then you do a review and you say, these 8 things, call it $800 a month, we're not even using. And that just would never have happened earlier on. So, I mean, I don't know if I'm just particularly bad at it personally, but I think just generally the discipline kind of wanes.
Do you view that as a problem?
I look much more at increasing revenue than decreasing expenses. So I generally don't view it as a burning problem, but you know, you don't want to be stupid and waste money. So I look at it as a small scale problem, where the larger problem is, by far the larger problem is growing revenue.
It's not so much the $100 a month cost that is the problem. It's like, okay, we're still paying for that tool, but is it actually doing the job that we need it to do? Like that's a good opportunity to revisit, like, have we truly solved that problem or not yet?
Yeah, we were so excited to remove intercom completely and save ourselves $400 a month. And then this morning we were like, we don't have any way to notify people in the app of things, do we?
Right.
Yeah. That's kind of why I asked, just because I was like, that $800 sounds like a lot per month, but I'm thinking about your time and the value that these things have provided. And like, if it's pure waste, clearly that's an easy win. But if it's kind of a gray area, like how much time did you spend evaluating these things and deciding to cancel them and whatnot? Jordan, if I were on your team, if I were a developer on your team and I wanted to sign up for a $100 a month thing, would I have to ask you?
You would just run it by me and I would almost never say no.
Gotcha.
You would just, hey, this thing looks cool. We want to use it for this. And I'd say, sounds great. You know, let me know what you need, sort of thing.
Gotcha. It's interesting. Because so one thing that Thoughtbot did that I thought was spectacularly savvy and good was there was this principle that was sort of like the rule zero of the company, which was use your best judgment. So if there's a question that could be answered by just assuming people are smart and well-meaning, then that's the answer. And there doesn't need to be a rule for it. And so signing up for a thing that was not like ridiculously expensive was considered just like, yeah, if you need this for your job, then that's like, you should don't even think about asking about it. And as those numbers go up and the possibility of problems go up, like you should get more and more people looped in to make sure you're doing something wise. But like $100 a month would, I think, would fall under the like, don't worry about it category.
So we talk about this internally about like, okay, myself as CEO and like the things I'm good at and things I'm bad at. So the general management style is like, do you have everything you need? Cool. Let me know if you need anything else, you know, other than like the weekly team leads meeting and that sort of thing and one-on-ones. So it's really a management style of like, use your best judgment. But there seems to be something, and I'm going to blame the like American business environment for it, that is very, very sensitive around money and very, very sensitive about being like argumentative. And it's almost like the way I put it is like, guys, I want to make our company more Israeli. Because in Israel, right where I'm from, argument is a form of conversation. That's how you get to the bottom of things. That's how you express yourself. And the American version of that, like, just holds it back. I mean, the most painful example of it was we had our
especially first in a workplace, like people try to avoid confrontation. You know?
Yes, yes. And they like don't know where the limits are and they don't want to upset the boss. I'm like, what are you talking about? Argue, man. That's how we figure things out. But it's been very hard to get to. The most painful experience was we had our first person quit. Right. So here I am. I'm all excited and I got my whole ego inflated about how things are going and rocking and moving forward. Who would ever want to leave this company right now? And then all of a sudden someone quits. I'm like, damn, it's not the same way I thought it was. And in reality, the reason they quit is because they were a technical support engineer. And then they had a bunch of experience doing engineering with us for about a year. And they got a job offer as a full like feature engineer. But when I pinged him and was like, dude, tell me, there's so much opportunity to work here. His response was, but the salary's going up like 50%. And I like didn't have the balls to tell you or ask you that. I'm like, why not? You know, so there are these barriers of communication. And I think that is an example of it, of like, do I really need to ask my boss for $100 a month? I think it's the right thing, but it does get complicated around money and around like debate.
All right. So I have a question, or at least a couple of questions for you guys that I wanted to run by you while I have you here. I took the medicine that I should be focusing on marketing. And the stage we're at is we're in development. We're hoping to launch an alpha pretty soon.
What's pretty soon? What's your target date to get something?
I'm 100% not going to commit to that in public.
Okay.
You madman.
True.
We're a long way from having like a page where you could go to and enter a credit card and sign up for the product. So I need something to focus on while we're in this stage that hopefully will later turn into customers. And I'm trying to figure myself out the best KPI. So I work pretty well when I have like, all right, here's my number. Let me figure out how to optimize the number. I'm trying to figure out what the best one for that. And what I've come up with so far, and this is what I want your thoughts on, is basically just new email subscribers for like the Tuple launch list per month. Does that make sense?
Brian, you're in this boat to an extent.
I am in
as
this
well.
Boat right now. Yeah. You're like Ben, you guys have been building the product for many more months than I have, but I'm now entering this boat of like, okay, I know I have many months ahead of building product. Mm-hmm. How should I spend that time to get that marketing ball rolling? Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the email subscribers for the early access list is important. That is a very important thing because it's like these people are very interested in potentially using the product. If the call to action is like sign up to hear about this product, not to sign up for some free course or something else, it's like sign up for this product that someday you can maybe use. Like for people to opt in for that, they're kind of interested.
Yeah. So but that's a refinement, right? That's not a let's grow our email list. Let's grow the email list of people who have expressed interest in using the product.
I would say that's important to the extent that like these are potentially your first customers and you want as many first customers as possible.
Yes.
The other thing that I would do that I do on ProcessKit is right behind that email opt-in, have a survey.
Yeah. I got to do that.
They join the list and then you ask them like five or six questions. What are you using now? Like what's your biggest pain point? What like so far what you've heard about Tuple, like do you have any questions about it? And then I use those survey responses as jumping off points for email conversations and calls with those people. And I don't do that with everyone, but I did that for the first batch of I label the best ones, the people who write the most and they seem like the best fit. In terms of that KPI, I think it's tough to keep that going as like a steadily increasing number. Like there's always a big spike in the beginning when you kind of first announce the new product, or if you go do a big podcast or something, you'll get a spike from that. Or if you do like a product hunt or like a something like, but like, it's hard to like just consistently week to week, month to month, see that number, like do activities that can drive that number up.
Why? So, isn't that my job?
Right, right.
Well, the thing that you'll want to get that I too want to get the ball rolling on is like just the traffic generation, like get the channels churning, whether that's content or, you know, a podcast or YouTube videos or like whatever it is that you're going to be doing that's going to keep activity coming to the site and then some percentage of those opting in for the early access.
My problem with this is that you're making a bunch of assumptions that you don't know are true. Right. And one of the key underlying assumptions in all the stuff that we're talking about in the form of activity to do, like generate email, is that you are assuming that the best way to get to revenue as quickly as possible is through individual sales of people who see your content, get on the list, and then buy. The goal of this exercise in the pre-launch period is to maximize the amount of revenue that you start off with, right? Gives you the best chance of success, the best chance of survival, just puts you on a different trajectory, right? We've heard Rob talk about how big of an advantage it was to launch Drip at like whatever 8 or 10K MRR. It just removes a year of pain. Mm-hmm. Now,
so you're saying focus on sales, focus on more pre-sales.
I think define the goal first. Is it to get as many people in the product as possible, as many customers as possible, or is it as much revenue as possible or much distribution? Like, what is the actual goal for when you launch for this period? So if you conclude that the best chance to do that is individual sales and say, okay, when we launch, the goal is to have as many people sign up in the first month after we launch, then you can kind of work backwards from there. But it could also be maybe I just need to do sales to larger organizations that are going to have 30, 40, 50 people using it. And maybe that's better off. That'll get me to 10K MRR faster.
Well, that's also why I was wondering literally like what's the time frame of potentially being ready? Because if like pretty soon means 2 months from now, yeah, I'd be ramping on sales. Like you could close deals and be like, yeah, we'll start onboarding you and we'll set a date for 2 months. And that's when you could actually start using it. But if it's like 6 or 8 months from now, that's more like it's a tougher sell.
So Jordan, what changes if it does look like the bigger teams are going to be who we want to go after?
Well, then a lower number of relationships matter a lot more, right? Having 10 great relationships along the way is much more valuable than having 1,000 email subscribers.
Interesting.
So I would worry about focusing only on one and not the other. I mean, something really interesting, I think like a phenomenon happening in software that a lot of people know about but don't talk about much is what's happening with Superhuman. Superhuman, that email client, is doing something. We haven't seen that in, I don't even know when the last time we saw something like that. There is a clamor for people to get in and apply to use this product. I got rejected because I use a MacBook Air, and that's just not good enough for them right now. So I just got denied. I'm like, I want to pay you $30 a month for email and you're not letting me. So they have like this simmering demand that when they open up, it's going to be a gigantic influx. So they're doing something right there. That doesn't mean that's the right thing for you to do, but it is an acknowledgement that there's a lot of different ways to do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other question, like back to what you were saying, Jordan, is like, what are the end goals? I would also ask personally for you, Joel and Spencer, like, is one of the goals like survival of the company, right? Because there's some sort of runway. At what date will you need salaries and what will those salaries need to be? And how much revenue do you need to have locked down in order to be paying yourselves enough to keep the company going? Like that seems to me like the most pressing goal.
Right. Is that the consideration, right? Or is it, we're not thinking about that. We were thinking about longer term. So I think this is the right place to start. All the way deep into what your goals are and why.
Tuple is naturally lends itself towards teams. And so I see teams being our bread and butter. I don't know how big those teams are going to be. And so I don't know if it's like, okay, yeah, teams of 5, or is it like with, you know, probably self-serve type sign up versus like teams of 50 with a drawn out sales process.
I've been new to the concept of pair programming. I'd never really heard of it until you talked about it. I've worked at web agencies before, but I haven't worked at like software development agencies before. So I don't know what pair programming in the context of a large team looks like. Is it most of the team pair programs like on a daily basis all year long? Or is it like every now and then on an as needed basis, we do a pair programming with like somebody who's applying to our company? Like,
I would say most common is closer to the latter than the former. There are some places that do full-time pairing, but they're kind of famous for doing full-time pairing. It's not common. I would say most places use it in a pretty ad hoc way, where it's like, this thing is particularly hairy. I could definitely use a second set of eyes. How about we pair on this? Mm-hmm. And that's probably the most usual way of using it.
So it's like, even if you sell to a company that has a large team, then it's like the question of like, well, how frequent, how useful are they going to see it in order to stay on?
I remember when we were building the checkout product, there was a lot, there was a good 6 months where I couldn't do anything, right? It was pretty useless. Whatever I did, like the guys building it were really the only important thing happening. Mm-hmm. But I used that time to dig all the way into what people wanted, what people were doing. I went into the Facebook groups. I just researched everything. And then I got into conversations. And those conversations were invaluable in bringing the feedback back into the product. So in your role, I would say building an email list, you're never going to regret that. You'll never look at that as a bad decision. But the other stuff, the non-KPI activity of let me talk to different types of companies and understand who's going to find this most valuable, there's no way the guys building the product can do that the same way you can. Mm-hmm. So I would just take guesses. I would say, look at something like, online code schools.
I was just going to say, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a good category for you, but I would definitely talk to three or four of them.
I've been working, and this is probably not a huge market or high revenue per user, but like I've been working with a coach weekly on Rails, and we're on a Zoom call, and half of that call he shares his screen, and then I switch to meet sir on my screen, and it's super clunky. And mm-hmm. and like in a coaching situation, a code coaching situation, it would be great. And certainly you can go to those code schools, the boot camps, mm-hmm. and they can work it into their actual program. You know,
a few of those relationships could get you off the ground in a much bigger way.
Yeah.
Yep.
I find myself continually recommending to other people to stop thinking about the scalable answer to things. And I'm sort of, now I'm finding myself doing, isn't it always the way I'm doing it myself? Yep. Where it's like, yeah, that point resonates with me very strongly, where it could be three or four relationships that bring in a bunch of revenue up front that make the difference between like runway going away or runway now infinitely extended.
That role of the CEO is to do things that the product people look at and say, how the hell did you do that? How did you find one random person online through a friend and get connected and have a conversation? All of a sudden you just brought in all this business. That's kind of like your magic. Like that's the thing only the CEO can do.
It's not just one KPI. Like I do think that the number one should be like get enough sales in lockdown so that we have some cash flow ready to go on day one, or pre-sales ready to go coming in now. I think that should be number one. But you have all the hours in the day. You've partners. So it's like you could work on multiple things. You can get things rolling on marketing. And I think the thing to also keep in mind is that like people who pre-buy and even people who just put their email for an early access, those are different types of customers than like I generally don't pre-buy things ever. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not that person. Sometimes I'll put my email address in for something, but like I'm not a pre-buy person. I'm not like a first adopter. If I'm going to buy something, I need it to be like already launched. And I think there's way more customers like that. In order to reach those at scale, you're going to need to have traffic channels. And this is something that I'm trying to think through as well. Like, look, the people who are likely to pre-buy from you are probably people in your audience or people that you've known or that you've been able to reach. Maybe some hand-to-hand sales, like cold sales could work for that too, but most of it is going to come from your audience. And I'm seeing that too. For me, but like if I can get some traffic channels going so that by the time we have a product, at least we have like a baseline level of traffic that we could start to build on and we're not starting from zero, you know? Mm-hmm. You're getting some juice from Google, or you know you have podcast episodes that are gaining in subscribers, like some sort of touch point to this market that can be ready to go once the product is out.
Brian, you said my first thing would be like get the sales. And Jordan, you're talking about building relationships with people, which is basically just like pre-sales, it sounds like, more or less, because I'm hoping they buy one day. It's sounding kind of like you guys are leaning towards marketing is the stuff I do to fill in the time, where it's like I'm trying to build these like scalable things and building an email list that happens passively and all that. But the bulk of the time is actually more single person, targeted, relationship driven, try to get them to buy now if they will. If not, try to figure out a lot about them, do a bunch of customer development.
I think you almost certainly have enough time to do both in the same week, like work on marketing and work on sales, and they work off each other. In your conversations with people who you would sell to or that you want to sell to, figure out what they're asking you back, the questions, the objections, the common use cases, and those inform content on your site. Those inform videos to make, those, you know, things to speak to, like little, like, you know, the general subject matter, but like there could be a weird little use case that is out there that you didn't really touch on until you spoke to somebody personally. And then, you know, that can open something up.
And the other way around too, the people who join your email list based off of a video you made on pair programming, that's your pool of candidates to pluck out and say, hey, you happen to work for a really interesting looking company. Let's get on the phone.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yep.
Like do things that don't scale, like find somebody in your drip email list, look at their email address, open up that website, dig into it, and then send them an email first line, be like, hey, I really like that cool thing on your homepage. Like,
totally. So in the very early days, when we first announced that we were doing this thing, that's what I was doing. And it turned into like $8,000 of pre-sales for like a product that had barely broken ground yet. And I stopped doing it because I was like, oh, well, I guess like, you know, we wanted a certain number of people in our alpha, and now the alpha is quote unquote full. So I guess I should stop doing this. But there was always part of me that was like, I was turning the pump and money was coming out, and I decided to stop turning the pump. I don't know that that's the best idea.
I think you could look at it in quantitative and qualitative. Like the quantitative people on the email list and revenue generated in the alpha and number of people in the alpha, right? The numbers. The qualitative is like the conversations. I used to say in the beginning days when if I had a day that I talked to a stranger, like someone I had never spoken to before, on the phone, not over email or on a Zoom call or something, then it was a successful day. So that is like super qualitative. It's just how many conversations, you know, that type of thing. But the fact that you turn those conversations into actual money and users, that's a good sign. But I hear you on the hesitation of not just continuing to push on that forever and getting, you know, $50,000 worth of pre-sales and just feeling very strange about all that pressure. But you should probably push yourself a little more.
Yeah, I think I should. I don't feel strange about the like, oh, we pre-sold too much. Actually, you know, I feel like it was an emotional thing. It was not a logical thing. It was just, I heard so many times people being like, you want me to prepay for a thing that doesn't exist? And I was like asking people to like do an annual prepay even. And 95% of people were like, you're crazy. And then 5% were like, yeah, we're in, we'll buy. And so like, but like the 95, I think just kind of got to me. And I was like, this is a little crazy. I do feel a little ridiculous. Yeah. And I think I just kind of let them win and stopped doing it.
Well, did you have like a second tier? Like, okay, if your first tier is yes, actually buy and prepay, and the second tier is no problem at all, but we'll get you in the beta and we'll follow up when we're ready. That's what I assume you.
Yeah,
but those aren't sales, but they're wins.
Yeah, right. I mean, those are like your next warmest leads to come back to, right?
Totally. Speaking of which, do either of you have like a CRM type thing that you don't hate?
Oh, Jesus, this conversation is impossible. Hey, everyone always ends up there. Always. We're looking.
I've been using Pipedrive.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Salesforce. Oh, man.
Wow.
That's where we've gotten to. Okay. That's where this conversation ends up.
Yeah. That's like a non-starter to me.
Why though?
There's a different
need. What do you do?
Yeah. What do you do?
I use Pipedrive. I like it. I
love
Pipedrive. I don't totally like my life doesn't depend on it. I just happen to like the interface. I don't know. And it's worked well enough. Hasn't been annoying enough for me to go switch. So that's it.
I hear you. I like Pipedrive too, but it doesn't do enough of what we need it to do. At some point, the need for a central repository of customer information just starts to be serious, right? Let's say last week, I was very unhappy.
I only use it for like pre-sales up to the close. After that, I don't use Pipedrive to track customers.
And, And that's our need. Our need is going all the way through. So yeah. Someone comes in, we want to keep track of them. Then someone turns into a paying customer. We want to understand it's the same person that we had these contacts ahead of time in chat. And then once they've been paying for 6 months and they come in and have a problem, we want to understand their history when their chat comes in.
Yeah.
Last week I got really upset at a support issue, and I didn't feel that the customer was treated the right way given who they were.
Given the history. Yeah. But, you know what? As a customer, that pisses me off.
It pisses you off. Like, dude, I'm a VIP customer. I pay you guys $2,000 a month. Why didn't you get back to me for 2 days?
I know.
But then I looked into it and I found out that we weren't piping in that data from Pipedrive all the way through into front. So when that chat came in, it was a heavy support week. That support person can't tell who this person is and what their background is. And then you start to get into, well, I guess we need something like Salesforce that
I know
life cycle.
I was on support with two well-known companies that everybody knows. I'm not going to call them out, but like, it was really pissing me off that things that I had an issue about like less than 2 weeks ago, like cropped up again. And I was talking to a different support rep, but it's like, dude, I'm not going to rehash the history of this issue. You should see it all there in Help Scout or whatever you're using.
Yep.
And they didn't. And I get a response back that like completely doesn't acknowledge what happened last month. And it's like,
give me the other person I was talking to last week.
So yeah. We all know that the tools are there. We all know that you can track that whole history. It's and I, as a customer, like I just assume that they are. But then when they don't, it's like, oh.
Yeah. So we looked at Salesforce. The sales process was great until it wasn't great. And then someone gave us bad info. And then you get into like the, okay, so you have to pay annually upfront for everybody. And then you have to pay for the customization. And it's like, this is going to be like 30 to 50 grand. And then you're like, Jesus, really? Is it worth it? And then you start to move around and people recommended Base CRM to us, and It's a tough thing. We definitely
don't. Can I just say, like, if anybody wants a lesson in how not to do a pricing page for your SaaS, go to Salesforce. I mean, holy shit!
Like, which product though? Because there are,
dude. I could not make sense of it. It was like, I'm so confused.
It's confusing to the point where just call them.
Yeah.
So Google Sheets is what you guys are saying.
Yes.
Okay, got it. Google Sheet, get back to work.
I think Pipedrive is amazing for that, a specific process. And it does have an API that developers can do more stuff with. So I use
a lot of Zapier apps with Pipedrive.
Yep. Anything like that, and you can create an individual funnel. So when I did fundraising, it was like, here's my little funnel, right? And here's just like who I've spoken to, and I can just define that however I want. But then at the same time, our customer success people now do get everything piped in. So a new account gets created. We automatically pipe that into Pipedrive. And then it's there. And then all the conversations are there. So that when it comes time to, let's say, like make them an offer for whatever, all the information's there. Fun.
Tools.
So many tools.
I should have known that I was opening a can of worms. So
the CRM thing.
The email conversation, the CRM conversation, the chat conversation.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who are like building SaaS, and then you inevitably, I get this question a lot, like, but can I use it as a CRM? Like, can I use this tool as a CRM? Like, so many people, it's like you don't intend to build it as a CRM, but people just ask for sales features and CRM features. And it's like, all right, you can kind of use it in this way if you want. I don't know.
I think the macro trend of it is interesting. The move from all in one, and then it swung all the way to really, really specific tools. And now it kind of comes back to, I just don't want to have 30 different tools. Just do more stuff for me because I like you and your company. So just keep doing more stuff for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I know that for us is like it's a balloon of features that has to constantly be stomped on. What else, gents? Should we talk about should we stop talking? I know more stuff happened in the funding world. I think that's kind of interesting and ongoing.
Yeah, I mean, any thoughts on that? Like before we wrap up, Ben, like because you know Jordan and I, we talked about Tiny Seed and that sort of that sort of landscape last episode, but I feel like things are continuing to move there. I mean, Ben, what do you think about all that?
I'm excited. I think the timing is very nice for us. So we're in a fortunate position to have started with a good amount of runway. And so our initial thoughts were like, yeah, no need for it. Hopefully we can make it all work ourselves and keep all our equity. And that'd be great. Nice and simple. As we build, it's like, wow, everything takes a long time. And we might, you know, hit the magic number by the time the runway's gone, or we might not. And so what do we do if that starts to look like it's not going to happen? And so it's nice to have these as a potential option kind of in the back pocket. I feel lucky enough that it's like there's more runway left. And so we can kind of wait. Cause like I would love to negotiate some sort of investment like this from a position of some proven traction and whatnot. So yeah. It's like, yeah, we have revenue. We just want to get revenue from here to, you know, 3x what it is.
So that tends to be my same thinking on that. Like from standing where I am today, I don't see a burning need to go that route. But I could see a year, maybe 18 months, 2 years, who knows, where it's like, we have traction. We don't want to let this thing die, but runway seems to be getting tight. This could be that bridge, you know?
All right. So the second one that came out this week was Earnest Capital, right? That's the right name, right? So Tyler Tingus, is that his name? And Kevin
Tringus, I think.
Tringus. Okay. And Kevin, the guy from SureSwift. So both cool guys in the bootstrapping world. Come out with another fund. And it seems to me like when you read the terms, when you read what Tiny Seed is talking about, when you read what Earnest Capital is laying out, it seems almost like they've already negotiated it for you. Whereas normally you want to go into that conversation with power, AKA customers and revenue, so that you can get better terms. But they've already defined good terms. So going in there with zero customers or 100 customers or zero in MRR and 10,000 in MRR, you going to get the same deal. They've defined what the deal is. We will take X and you get Y.
As much as I love like a productized model, very standard across the board, I wonder in this market, is that the right approach, both from the fund and from the startup? I mean, is every startup equal? Does every startup come with the same level of risk? I don't know.
No, but it certainly seems easier to be able to take a class. Right? Tiny Seed specifically does not appear to be a venture fund in like, come pitch us and we'll see what kind of deal we can make. It really feels like an incubator where you're applying for this season's class, right? This cohort for the fall of 2019, and this is the deal you get. And if you do it that way, you kind of need to standardize it. And then really what you're trying to do is you're trying to be good enough to get in, as opposed to good enough to have stronger negotiating position. In some ways, if you have just enough to get into the cohort and get the investment, you're actually better off than doing the year of work with your own money and then applying, because you would have gotten the same deal anyway.
I am curious to see how all of these things, you know, roll out, and as more details come out, we'll learn more. But the other thing that I wonder about is like, okay, think about it like a product. Like, what are you selling me? What is the problem that you're solving? Is it money so that runway is extended? Or is it mentorship so that I have guidance and network connections that I wouldn't have otherwise had? It seems like those are two different, maybe they're two benefits that are both valuable, but they do seem like two different problems that are being solved. And like, to me, I don't know that I'm totally sold on like giving away equity just for the mentorship piece. I would give away equity for the funding if we needed it. Not that the mentorship is not valuable, but is it equity valuable? And can I not get mentorship and advice in other places that I already get it from? I don't know. Like,
it sounds like a differentiator for the fund. It's like, here's a landing page tool without any templates. It's like kind of useful. Here's a landing page tool with a whole bunch of templates to get you started. Just makes it more valuable.
If we're in the stance of like, we are seeking funding, let's look at our options.
Yeah.
And this one offers great mentoring with great people, and that one doesn't. Yeah, that's a benefit. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's the reason to go that route, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, it depends what runway means. Because just because you have runway, if that runway is in the form of your savings that you just worked really hard for a few years, that sucks to burn that runway. that sucks. That you need that. And if someone's offering you that runway, it's not like a replacement of your runway. It is an addition to your runway. Then you don't have to spend your own savings. That is a gigantic, gigantic benefit. And giving away equity just means that you're in a slightly different ballgame. You're not in the, let me make sure I keep all of my pie. You're in the, let's make sure the pie gets big enough so that it's meaningful. Especially if these guys come to you and say, we've already negotiated against ourselves, so you don't have anything to lose. Because if you want to pay us back, if it's really successful, just give us back 3X and we don't even own any equity. Right? They're trying to make the pitch to you where you don't really have that much to lose. If it's really successful, you just pay them back. If it's not successful, then you didn't burn your life savings. It's like, yeah. I don't know. My argument is like, if someone's going to give you money under those terms, you take it, baby, and you run.
I do think that's a pretty good argument. The one thing that I would push back on is either you or they are buying equity with dollars. So like you could say like, it sucks that I'm spending my savings, but I'm sort of, I don't think of it that way so much. Like, yes, that money is going towards rent and food, but the thing it's really actually doing is buying my time so that I can hang on to equity. If I sell equity to somebody for dollars, it's because they think those dollars are worth less than the equity. There's kind of like that inherent, like, we think you're doing something that's kind of not dumb, but like, we think we're getting the better end of this bargain. There's a counterpoint there, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the only thing is like, right, my response to that is that all money isn't equal. Your money that's in your bank account after taxes that can pay your rent, food, emergencies, travel, life is more valuable to you than equity that might be worth more in the future.
There's a very huge, just a huge difference between zero customers and like 10 customers in terms of where your focus and priorities should be. Like, because before you get to 10 paying customers, which is still basically nothing, but what I'm saying is that like before you get to that point, so many things could change your course. Like, oh, the product market fit isn't there, or lost a key member of the team, or something changed in the market, or the technology just couldn't execute on it. Like all these things could happen at that early stage, where it's like if you're bootstrapping and you have some runway to get through that stage and you get beyond 10 customers and you see traction and movement, then you're in a much different position to go and seek that funding and that sort of like commitment to a program like that. Whereas it's like, I feel like it pre-revenue, it's like so many things are like, you still need to prove it to the company itself, I think.
I don't know. I feel like if you have a year of runway of your own money, what does someone else's money do? It gives you another year of runway. So now you have 2 years of runway and you get to burn their money first. I like Paul Graham's, what's his saying? Just stay alive long enough and you get rich. Right. You just have to make it through. And that's the hardest thing.
But if you took that money and like the whole product changes, the whole customer changes.
Right.
Wouldn't you want to have that money later rather than sooner?
No, you want as much money as possible now. You can decide what to do with it. And you have longer amount of time.
Okay, because I mean, if things change and you have to go back to the drawing board to literally ground zero to go find a new target customer and a new product to sell them, and you've already taken money, I would want some breathing room to get back to the point where it's like, okay, we have a pretty good direction with this product. Now let's take the money and really execute on that for a year.
What's the difference? If you have $150,000 of your own money and $150,000 of investor money, right? You have $300,000 total. If you start off without getting investment, so you just run with your own $150K and you run for a year and you spend all $150K and you say, well, shit, we need to go back to the drawing board. Now I'm going to go look for another $150K of investment. It might not be there for you at that time. As opposed to on day one saying, I'll take all 150 of yours. I'll take 150 of mine. Now I have 300 to figure it out. You go through a year, you spend 150, you change direction, and now you still have 150 in the bank. It's like, it just sets you up for a higher likelihood of success.
I don't know why would the money not be there when you do have customer attraction versus not having like a proven idea yet. You
know? Because that assumes, my only argument is if you can get it, take it. If you've been running with your business for a year and you have $1,000 in MRR, you're less likely to get that investment. As opposed to if you've been running your business for 2 months and have a good idea and two people on a team that are attractive based on their histories, if they're willing to give you money at that stage, then you take it. I've firmly crossed over to the dark side.
Oh yeah.
Gotta change the podcast name.
True.
I should say that I feel like a lot of these conversations, more like the ones that I read in articles and tweets and stuff, like calling it like a religion with bootstrapping and like this, I don't think it's like that. I feel like bootstrappers constantly have to be like, just so we're clear, we're not anti-funding.
I think most things get turned into a bit of a like us versus them or like black and white kind of situation, when in reality, there's nuance.
Yeah, you see it in every Twitter convo, right? Someone says something and then you start reading the comments below it and it gets directly into that. Well, what if it's not a VC business and it can't get to $1 billion? And it's just like the same stuff over and over.
Right, who cares anyway? Like this like a semantic distinction.
Yeah. And every...
It's not a very interesting thing about your business, honestly.
Every person's situation and every founder's and co-founder's situation is different from the next, you know, whether they're bootstrapping or not. And it's...
The genuine problem with raising institutional money whose only interest is going really, really big is that if it morphs your business into something that you didn't want it to be, intended to be, that it shouldn't be, and so on, and that causes a higher likelihood of failure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Funding mechanisms, I don't think they do that. And so I don't see that much downside in taking the funding, because it doesn't fundamentally change what you would do with the business, which is like the valid argument for taking institutional money that you didn't want to, or just because it's there or something like that. If it doesn't fundamentally change the nature of how you would approach the business, but it gives you more breathing room, that's the part where I see these new funding mechanisms and these new opportunities that they don't have that much downside. And we'll see that over the next 2-3 years, and we'll see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, gents. Well, let's wrap this up.
At least we didn't end on Salesforce. Okay. Cool. Awesome. Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
You know, guys, I got to say, I've been a fan of the podcast for a long time, so it's a real treat to be on as a guest.
Cool.
And same to you, man. Yeah, always a fan of what you and Derek and your partners at Tuple have been up to. So Art of Product podcast, I'm a huge fan of that one. And of course, Tuple. Is it Tuple.io?
No, Tuple.app.
I got to start like getting domains right before I say them on air, because I do that every show.
It's all good.
Cool. We're looking forward to seeing what you guys do with that. And we're looking forward to talking with you again, Ben.
Sounds great.
Later.